Thank you so much, Jeremy. What a warm welcome, and it's a pleasure to be here. I'm finally getting to leave Oxford more regularly, which is good. Thank you for taking time to come out on a Wednesday evening to hear what somebody might say to the question, is there anything special about being human? And actually, we find that many contemporary debates cause us to think about human identity and value. If we think about some of the topics in public discourse today, we don't go far away from this question. Debates around artificial intelligence and whether or not androids will one day supersede humans in their abilities, or debates around the beginning and end of life, or around stem cell research and cloning, or debates around animal welfare, or veganism, or the causes of climate change and human role in that. You know, each of these areas causes us to ask the question, what exactly are human beings? And from that, what is our remit on this earth? Is there anything that makes us different from even the most advanced apes? Or have we simply managed to become the dominant species on the planet and climbed ourselves to the top of the food chain? And if we do have some sort of inherent value, well, is this inherent or is it acquired? Is it something that we've gradually built up over time? Or is it based on our productivity and our contribution to society? Is it to do with who we are or is it to do with what we do? And so there are all kinds of questions out there that are never too far away, actually. And the question of human identity also has personal relevance to us. What is the value of my life in a city of millions, in a world of billions? We're all racing around, doing our thing. Does it mean anything? Is there any value to it? Do I have value that is independent of my family background, my education, my salary, my state of health, and my contribution to society? Do I have value despite seemingly being a blip on the landscape in a vast cosmos? Because if we look purely to the scientific narratives, we see that human beings are very, very insignificant indeed. We live in a cosmos that has been around for 12 billion years, on an Earth that has been around for 4.5 billion years. If we were to look at the whole lifespan of history as a 24-hour period, humans have arrived in the last second, the last 200,000 years. And so that's humanity in general. But one human life, your life, my life, is even less insignificant. And it is precisely on the basis, on the belief that we live in a material universe with no God, that people like the 20th century philosopher and atheist Jean-Paul Sartre believed that there was nothing inherently valuable or special about humans. Because God doesn't exist, he said, there is no ultimate grounding for humanity. And a number of scholars today would draw similar conclusions, and these are expressed in all kinds of different ways. Francis Crick, who you will know from co-discovering the DNA double helix, is also said to have said in another book that humans are nothing but a pack of neurons. You are your brain, basically. We've heard historian Yuval Harari in his book Homo Deus say that humans are algorithms. We've heard the ethicist and utilitarian Peter Singer say that there's no difference between humans and animals. He's well known for his views on animal rights, advocating that they should be treated equally to humans. And he coined the term speciesism to denote when preferential treatment is shown to humans over and above animals. And of course, Darwin would have argued that, yes, we may have arrived at certain traits that may set us apart from the animal kingdom, but those have been acquired. They're not inherent to who we are. They have developed over time. And of course, now people like Max Tegmark and Ray Kurzweil and other writers on AI would take this even further and say that because there's nothing inherently unique about us, we humans may one day be superseded by an ultra-intelligent machines. And this may lead to what is known as the singularity, where the point at which machines are able to far surpass all the intellectual activities of any person. And so according to this view, there's nothing inherently special or unique about people. It's expressed in lots of different ways. And we are therefore free to create our own identity according to our own preferences. That's something that Sartre was very much in favor of. People can shape their own identity and create a life that has value. There's nothing inherently valuable, but go ahead and create some value if you want to. And so then we're into the realm of value, and identity comes from what we do and what we can contribute. And many of us do live according to this mantra, don't we? We live in a society steeped in the mindset that human value is related to what we produce, what we create, what we achieve. Some of us spend a lifetime trying to bolster our significance by striving for success at work or at home, or by trying to make a name for ourselves in the world or through relationships. This approach says that you are valued for what you do, for what you bring to the table. And that's fine if it's all going well. But if those things start to crumble, what happens to our sense of value? But if we really do live in a godless universe of matter, and that is all that there is, there's a disparity here. Why are we even bothering to seek to create an identity and get value from this? Why? Why can't we just be? If this is just the way it is and there's no inherent value, why are we trying to create a sense of value? Why not just go with it rather than trying to change the status quo? It's as though there's a pull towards the notion that we do have value. We want some kind of value and worth. Well, where does this come from? Is it possible that there is a grounding to human beings that doesn't change? And aside from the question of whether or not packs of neurons, by the way, are capable of saying, doing, or thinking anything meaningful at all, there's a whole host of things we could say about that. We don't actually live as though we are merely packs of neurons. We don't live as though human beings have no value. Just look at the news feed. We live as though people are inherently valuable. We see this in things like anti-trafficking campaigns that are based on the belief that no one should be in slavery, or human rights campaigns by those that believe that no one should be denied justice or be a prisoner of conscience, or the Black Lives Matter and civil rights movement that strive for racial equality and a world in which people are, all people, are seen as having inherent dignity regardless of their skin color. Or we could recall women's rights movements, for example, that of the suffragettes or suffragists at the beginning of the 20th century, who campaigned for the right for women to vote based on the belief that all people ought to have a voice in society, both men and women. Or we could point to the Me Too campaign, calling out abuse in the film industry and in other spheres. Each of these movements and more center around the belief that human beings have inherent value and worth regardless of their country of origin, their cultural background, their social status, economic status, marital status, gender, physical ability, mental capacity, and age. And therefore, each person alive deserves to live with dignity. Now, this hasn't come from nowhere. And that's really the purpose of what I want to say to you. You know, philosophers and thinkers have voiced this in different ways. We could point to the 18th century German philosopher Immanuel Kant, who described human beings as having irreplaceable value. He said that humans have an inherent dignity and worth that cannot be substituted for by anything else. And there may be possessions that we consider to be valuable, but according to Kant, humans are in a different category altogether. Every human being is unique and irreplaceable, and a value can never be placed on a person's life. But that raises a question. If it's true that we do have irreplaceable value, where does this come from? What is the most compelling basis for human value and dignity? And of course, people from all kinds of beliefs and backgrounds believe that humans have inherent dignity. And the question here is not whether people of different beliefs treat their fellow human beings with respect. Of course, that is the case. But rather, I'm asking the question, what is the most persuasive and compelling basis for human dignity of all the different options available? Now, if God doesn't exist and we live in a universe of time plus matter plus chance and the forces of nature, we live in a universe that does not have value as a concept built into it. It has matter. It has valueless matter. And so for humans to arise with inherent value doesn't necessarily follow from the starting conditions of that setup. It could happen, but it would be an incidental occurrence. However, if we live in a universe in which God exists, then we live in a value-laden universe from the beginning. It's been baked into the ingredients of the universe from the outset. And therefore, human beings with inherent value and worth is exactly what we would expect. You see, the Christian faith has a clear basis for human dignity. It says that we do have irreplaceable value, as Kant tells us. This value comes from being made and known and loved by God, the God who has been there from the beginning. You see, right at the beginning of God's creative work, it says in the opening verses of the book of Genesis that human beings are made in the image of God, which is a little bit like saying they're made with his kind of imprint. Some of his qualities are kind of imprinted onto human beings. And if you like, humans are kind of a high point in the creative process. And of course, the Genesis accounts are the subject of much conversation and debate, and how you make sense of them and interpret them is a whole nother conversation that we could have. But just by way of summary, after kind of creating elements and planets and landscapes and vegetation and sea life and land animals, we then have this point in the creation narrative. Now, I'm not saying anything about how long or how long ago or by what process. If you want to ask me about that, fair enough. But then it says this: then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule or have responsibility over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God saw that all he had made, and it was very good. So we hear these words that we're made in the image of God. What does that actually mean? Well, there's lots of different ways that you could shine light on this idea of being made in the image of God. I'm going to highlight three of them. There are actually more. The first thing we could say is that human beings are uniquely able to think and reason in a way that animals and other mammals aren't able to. One of the reasons that we know that we're not just packs of neurons is because we don't just have a brain, we also have a mind. There is something that it is like to be you. You also have thoughts and memories and emotions and not just neurons and chemicals and cell voltages. There's something that it's like to be you, that capturing data from your brain isn't going to kind of tell you about in quite the same way. And so as human beings, we're able to think higher thoughts and we're able to reason in ways that even the most advanced apes are not able to. We have a mind. You see, brains don't think. People think using their brains. Why? Where does the conscious mind and our sense of self come from? Why can we even think at all? Well, again, we come back to this question of in what kind of universe does the idea of a conscious mind sit most comfortably? Is it one, a godless universe of time plus matter plus chance and non-conscious forces of nature and non-conscious brain processes? Or is it one in which right from the beginning there was consciousness woven into the fabric of the universe? Because in the beginning, God existed, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and has made human beings to reflect his consciousness. Augustine of Hippo was one of the first to argue that our ability to think and reason is traceable to being made in the image of God, and it is one of the things that sets humans apart from other creatures. In other words, we have a mind because God has a mind. We think because he does. And to be a Christian is to be a thinker. Now, I haven't always actually been a Christian. I started life as an agnostic, and I arrived at university as an agnostic, and I was studying biochemistry, and I assumed that you couldn't be a scientist and believe in God at the same time, and I think I had absorbed the view that to be a person of faith meant to be an unthinking person, and that was quite off-putting. But I want to reassure those of you that might have heard that. It's actually the opposite. It's actually if God exists that you can make sense of why you have a mind in the first place. And the very using of that mind is a reflection of what it means to be made in the image of God. So humans are uniquely able to think and reason. The second thing we learn from these Genesis verses is that human value is inherent rather than functional. You know, we live today as though humans have inherent value. It is very much woven into Western society. One of the examples of how we see this played out might be in the area of healthcare. We are so accustomed to the notion that everyone ought to have access to good healthcare and receive medical treatment if they need it. And the NHS was formed and established after World War II for this very purpose. Early on in the first lockdown, we had a tradition of applauding our NHS staff for the work that they were doing to care for the vulnerable, and for good reason. But historically, it has not always been the case that all people are seen as equal in value and therefore worthy of being cared for if they are ill. In the Greco-Roman world, the approach to illness was very different. Those with illnesses and disabilities and deformities were seen as weaker. Babies that were disabled and newborn were often left outside to die because they were not seen as useful, able to contribute to society. During times of plague in the ancient world, it was common for, if you could, if you had the money, get out of town. Because get to the countryside. There's no plague in the countryside. You're more likely to survive. The sick and the poor had no choice but to stay in the cities to fend for themselves. Now, this self-serving approach may jar with our modern Western thinking, and yet it was an entirely normal response that flowed from the belief that some people just were more valuable than others. And human value was related to what you could contribute, and illness lowered your value because you suddenly became a burden to society. But if people are made in the image of God, that means that we are not valued for what we do or what we bring or what we contribute. We are actually valued for who we are. There's something undergirding and certain and unchanging about our value if it's true that God exists and we're made in his image. And that is why in the ancient world, the Galileans, or what is known as the Christians, they stayed in the cities at great risk to their own lives, and they cared for the sick. They showed charity and hospitality to the sick. That's where we get our word hospitals from, precisely on the basis of this notion that all people are created equal in value before God, and therefore all are deserving of healthcare. And so belief in this inherent dignity of all people has formed the basis of Western society. It began to be built into political structures from around the 4th century. It has formed the basis of human rights that we have seen throughout the centuries. But it hasn't come from nowhere. And you don't get it from any and every system of belief. Now, if we each have intrinsic value, what difference might that make to us as individuals? Because it's one thing to think about systems and structures, but what about us as people? If it's true that we have inherent dignity and value before we even get out of bed on a morning, before we do anything, before we contribute anything to society, even if we never do, we are still inherently valuable and loved. Well, it means that we are freed from needing to manufacture an identity of our own. In a sense, is that really a freedom? You've got to keep coming up with the goods, and if one plan fails, you've got to switch to another one. You know, if God is real, he wants to actually free you from that. Say, you don't need to do that because you've got value already. It comes from me. I made you. And nothing will ever change it. Even if you change, even if your body deteriorates, even if you're taken out of the workplace, your inherent value will never change. And so there's a freedom that can come if we come to kind of think about this idea of being made in the image of God. And then thirdly, the other thing that we learn is that human beings are equal to each other in value and dignity. There are so many conversations and campaigns today around the reality that there is inequality, not just expressed by individuals, but at a systemic level within institutions and within organizations. There is rampant inequality, and trying to change it is a lifetime's work. But the view that not all people are created equal is far from new, and it has been expressed since the ancient world. Did you know that Plato, in his dialogue Gorgias, said of human beings that justice consists in the superior ruling over the inferior? In other words, some people were simply born better than others, and nothing can be done to change this. Similarly, Aristotle didn't just condone slavery, he defended it, believing that some men are slaves by nature and some men are free. Further, on the relationship between men and women, Aristotle believed that the relation of male to female is by nature a relation of superior to inferior and ruler to ruled. That is the backdrop. And yet the author of Genesis says something radically different. We are taken even further back than ancient Greece to the very creation of human beings and are told that all people are made in the image of God with equal value and worth before God. Genesis makes no distinctions in human value on the basis of gender, race, or ethnicity. In fact, these are expressions of God's diversity and generosity in creation and are to be celebrated, not subjugated. And whenever oppressive regimes have risen to power, those that protest and campaign for justice are doing so on the basis of this mandate, that there can be no preferential treatment of some human beings over and above others, because all are equal in value because they are made in the image of God. And some have made it their life's work to fight to overturn inequality on behalf of others. We could remember Nelson Mandela and apartheid, or Martin Luther King Jr., who paid with his life in the civil rights movement, or Rosa Parks, a political activist and known for the Montgomery bus boycott, or Harriet Tubman, who rescued over 70 slaves in her lifetime. But even if there is something special about human beings, it often isn't part of our lived experience. Luther King Jr. didn't get to see his dream fulfilled. Many still today experience discrimination, abuse, prejudice from others, or we may at times even elevate ourselves above others, seeing them as less valuable, or we may even see ourselves as worthless. All of these go to the very core of our being, the very core of our humanity. They can lead to feelings of deep despair and of low self-esteem that many carry with us for a lifetime. And the Christian story is that these all happen because, yes, we've been made in the image of God, but the image of God has also been marred. There's a brokenness that has come in, a vertical brokenness between human beings and God. There's a fracturing of our relationship with God, and that has led to all kinds of other fractures as well. But is it possible to live in a way that is anchored as an individual, even if systemically we're still fighting that battle? Well, if God exists, yes. Because there is a God who sees us, who sees all the good and the bad, and who still offers us love and acceptance. And that can be a terrifying concept, the notion that somebody kind of sees you. It can be terrifying, all the good and the bad. And I was really struck by some words that an author and speaker once wrote. He said this: to be loved but not known is comforting but superficial. To be known and not loved is our greatest fear. But to be fully known and truly loved is, well, it's a lot like being loved by God. You see, if God exists, then before we were even born, before we contributed anything useful to the world, we were known and loved by God, and nothing can change this. And despite the vastness of the universe, we are seen and known by our Maker. The astronaut Buzz Aldrin was reminded of this during his journey home from the moon landings of 1969, while surrounded by the vastness of space, when he could have had good reason to say, oh my goodness, we are incredibly insignificant. Instead, he asked for silence at NASA and read the words of Psalm 8 over the radio. And they say this: When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them. You've made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. And we have a unique capacity to know and relate to this God. That is another thing that sets us apart from the other creatures, that we have capacity to use our minds to know and relate to God, and we are invited into friendship with him. God can be known. And as I close, a couple of questions. How do we know, how do we truly know that we have value? Well, value, firstly, is communicated through time and attention, right? In our world of smart devices and social media, some people say that your full attention is the most valuable currency that you have. We give time and attention to the things that we value most. Right? The Christian story is about God, a God that was so invested in people that he became one of us. You see, humans are valued to the extent that God himself was willing to take on human flesh and come and be a human being himself and look people in the eye and say, society might say you are worthless, but I say you are priceless. And we saw him again and again do that. People that the society had pushed to the margins, Jesus brought back into the center, reinstating the image of God in that person and saying, you are inherently valuable. Your life matters, and I'm going to do something about it. There's a story of a woman who had been bleeding for 12 years, and she was economically bankrupt. She'd spent all of her money trying to get doctors to help her. They couldn't help her. She was emotionally spent because it was 12 years. She was socially ostracized because to be bleeding meant that you couldn't go near anyone else. You had to just be on your own, some far-flung place. And she saw Jesus, and she managed to just, if I can just touch the edge of his cloak, he will heal me. And Jesus, in this big crowd of people, noticed that something had happened. He said, something, power has gone out from me. Somebody touched my cloak. Who did that? And this woman tries to avoid him, but he turns around, and she eventually comes to him and falls at his feet. And she realizes that at that moment, her bleeding had stopped. And Jesus says some extraordinary words to her that might be lost on us today. They don't sound that radical. But in an age when men did not speak to women in public, they certainly didn't speak to women who had been bleeding for 12 years. He says some extraordinary words. Daughter, your faith has healed you. Daughter, your faith has healed you. This woman was free. Jesus sets people free. He set people free then. He does it now. Value is communicated through time and attention. And finally, value is communicated by the price that we are prepared to pay for something. Anyone who has sold their house or tried to sell something on eBay or another network or platform will know that the value of something is entirely determined by what people are prepared to pay. And the Christian faith says that we are out of kilter with God. There is a brokenness between humanity and God, between each individual person and God. It's something that Christian faith calls sin. There's a brokenness. And we're not able to fix this for ourselves. We need someone who is without sin to come and fix it for us. We needed someone to pay on our behalf to mend this brokenness. And what was the price that God was willing to pay for us? Well, he was willing to pay the highest possible price that there is. the price of the life of God himself, the life of his son, Jesus Christ. The most famous verse perhaps in the whole Bible is John 3:16, which says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life." If you're wondering whether your life matters, or whether your life has any value, even though you might be having a highly successful career, or family, or marriage, or boyfriend, girlfriend, even despite those things, you might be wondering, what am I here for? Does my life have value? If you take nothing else away tonight, please know this. Jesus Christ gave his life for you so that you can have life, so that you can know. He was willing to die so that you can live. And that is the secret to life. There's a notion that we just follow our dreams and go for self-expression, and that's the route to freedom. He says, no, come to know me, the truth, and the truth will set you free. That is what happened to me in my 20s as a biochemist studying. I came to know not just a principle or a philosophy, but a person who set me free and said, I love you, you are loved and valued. And this is available to anyone and everyone. And so maybe that's something you want to think about. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to taking your questions.
Well, Sharon, thank you so much for that. That's amazing. I feel like behind almost every sentence, we could double click and start to get inside that brain.
Yes, definitely.
The human person here. I think we're going to take a few minute break. So there might be some drinks still, maybe some snacks. Feel free to grab a snack, another drink, go to the toilet. If you have questions, I will start with a few questions from these papers. So if you want to take right now those questions, we'll come around and collect those, and then we'll open up the floor. I want to take a moment to do that, and we'll come back in a few minutes to answer your questions. Thanks so much.
future.
Okay, so we've got lots of questions. I'll do a few of these. If we don't get to your question, which we're obviously not going to get to all of these, please do. We'll chuck these back out to you guys, and please raise your hand and ask the question that way. You've got your microphone. Okay, great. So, let me start the one I had. What would you say to the idea of secular morality as a pathway to identity or meaning? Particularly, many would argue the Bible's not divine. So how would you respond to the idea that the secular worldview should give me meaning and identity?
I think that it comes back to this idea of kind of creating your own meaning and identity. I think, I think the secular worldview is still a belief that's saying that God doesn't exist, and therefore there isn't any inherent meaning, but we can create it. So we can get really passionate about, particular causes, and we can, really get into our kind of areas of study and advance kind of intellectual, just thinking in whatever field that would be, or it could be, in the area of leisure. And I'm sure that there probably are more sophisticated theories about kind of how you might develop those things, but it keeps coming back to this idea that if there isn't anything, if there isn't a bedrock of anything inherent, you do have to kind of, it's up to you to create it. And of course, many incredible things and works are kind of carried out by people that wouldn't necessarily hold to a belief in God. And many causes are advanced and many discoveries are made. But those things in and of themselves, they contribute to society, but it's all a kind of a creating of identity. So, yeah, I think it would kind of come back to that.
Okay, that's really helpful. Let's just pull back a little bit to some of your work in the book, just my brain. You touched on the idea of the existence of the mind. And I just wonder if you could, so I was asking, kind of how could you tell us a bit more about why you believe in the mind, why we're not just a kind of brain or, say, a bag of neurons?
Pack of neurons.
Essentially, what is your basis in saying that there is such a thing as a mind?
So essentially, I mean, if we were to do a study where we wanted to find out what it is like for you to, go through your next audit at work or sit your next set of exams, we want to find out what it's like for you to do that. And we put an EEG cap on you and collect some very interesting EEG data from your skull. And we put you in an MRI scanner and we collect some structural scans and functional scans. We get some very interesting data from your brain while you go through this process of the audit or sit the exams. But will that tell us what it is like for you to go through that process? Well, it won't. For that, we need to ask you. There's a you that sits, that is part of your makeup, that actually data from your brain doesn't access. And it's that, really, and this is not a new question. It has been debated for many centuries, beginning in the ancient world. There are many, there are many philosophers and agnostics and atheists alike and scientists that argue that, we have a brain, but we do also have a mind. There's a sense of self that can't be captured by cell voltages and chemical reactions. And therefore, we need to try and explain that. Yeah. Okay,
that's really helpful. Kind of judging back now to more theological, I suppose, if we're inherently priceless, fully known by God and loved, can't we just live as we wish, as long as we don't harm other humans? If my life feels full enough as it is, why do I need to relate to God? And then they say thank you for the talk.
Thank you for the question.
I realize that's two questions, but God?
Yeah, thank you. A really great question, and I appreciate your honesty. And, you know, forgive me for the crude example, because I probably need to think of a better one. But if we're talking, so if we're talking about the God that made us, then built into that is the notion that the God that made us would know best how we are most going to flourish and function. A bit like the person that wrote the kind of instruction manual for whatever it is that we're building is actually, that's the, you need to keep referring to that in order to have the full potential of the whatever it is that you're building. And so the idea being that God himself, if he's the one that has made us in his image, then he also has a kind of a blueprint for how we are best going to flourish as people. And the way to human flourishing, contrary to what society would tell us, is not simply to define that ourselves, but actually to connect with God and help and let him kind of work that in us. It's a bit of an enigma because it seems very counterintuitive, and it often is a denial of what we might sometimes want to do. Jesus is really clear. If anyone wants to come after me, you must deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me. Now, that doesn't mean we all travel to the top of a mountain in our bare feet and that's it for the rest of our lives. But there's a sense in which there is a counterintuitiveness to what it means to flourish as a human being. Jesus has some really interesting things to say on this, but it's actually in relationship with him and God the Father that we reach our biggest potential as people, because we are connecting with the God that made us, who knows what it is that is going to enable us to flourish. And I do believe that actually God has plans and purposes for people on this earth, that you know, none of us in this room are here by accident, that he has things for us that he wants to do in our lives, that actually we will be more alive for doing them than for not. There are also other things that it wouldn't be so helpful for us to do, and we will be more alive for not doing them than for doing them. But it's all in the interest of human flourishing. God is for us, not just interested in rules for their own sake. He actually cares about human beings.
The second part of that question, or the other part, was someone saying, what about the idea of I don't really feel a need for God, which kind of, I suppose, relates back to your saying, in a sense, this is the basis for human identity and value. It's possible I don't really feel that need.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that question as well. I appreciate the honesty. The thing that Christianity centres around that I didn't really talk about in the talk is that Jesus claims that he lived and he died and he rose from the dead and he conquered death. And that is a historical event. Historians, regardless of what they believe about God, they all agree that Jesus lived and died. Of course, they debate whether he rose from the dead, but there's some quite interesting evidence that you might want to look at. And so the question of need kind of reaches a point when it's like, well, what happens beyond this life? Is there life beyond this one? Because what's on offer is Jesus says, I'm the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will live even though they die. And so what the situation I ended up in was like, well, I probably need to check out whether that's true or not. Because that actually goes beyond need if I'm actually no longer alive. And actually what's very helpful to those of you that are thinking, well, again, that takes me into the realm of miracle and that's a bit unthinking, that you can actually come to that belief on a relatively rational basis. There's some evidence. There's some like, well, why didn't the disciples just hide the body? Why didn't perhaps the Romans stole the body? Perhaps, you know, everybody hallucinated. And I can unpack all of that if you want me to. Or there's some, you know, I'm sure that Jeremy can point you to a couple of books. Gary Habermas is a very good person to read. There's a book by a lawyer who set out to disprove the resurrection using all the different evidences, and he ended up changing his mind. That's Frank Morrison, who moved the stone, and there are others out there as well. So I would really want to encourage you and draw your attention to the fact that the Christian belief anchors around a historical event. Whether people felt like they needed it or not, Jesus died and rose again. Our job as thinking people is to decide whether we believe that was genuine or not. Because if it happened, it's kind of true for all of us, regardless of what we feel our needs are, or it's true for none of us. So I would just encourage you to look into that evidence for yourself. Don't just take someone else's word for it. Look at it yourself.
Okay. Zach, our glamorous assistant, Zach, he's not really glamorous before, I imagine, but anyway. Zach is going to run around and ask your questions. So, has it not answered?
Yay!
You can ask them, and then Sharon will answer. Who's first? It's really helpful. Many of you haven't had any questions answered yet, so you should, one of you should ask. Who has a question for us? Go on then. You can say your name and you ask a question as well.
Why did those sick people need to be, you know, healed altogether if they simply have value regardless of whether they're sick, you know, dying, that sort of thing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, thank you for that question. I suppose it's the next obvious step that is an outworking of, if you have value, I don't just want to leave you where you're at. And most people that are sick don't want to stay sick. They want to be well. And so the outworking, the expression of the truth that you have value is that if I've got the capacity to change your situation, then I will. I won't just do nothing. To do nothing in the face of a hurting person is to kind of like just pour coals on, you know, or whatever the phrase is. I'm losing vocab now. It's nearly 9 o'clock. So it's kind of it's the next outworking of the belief and the truth that that person had value to make them well so that they can live out a valueful life as a whole person and healed and whole person.
Great.
Thank you for the question.
Well, who's next?
Actually, it's a little bit complicated because there are more questions than one. Well, I don't question the fact that we have value as humans. What I always question is, we have a sense of self, it's true, but also a few animals actually have this kind of sense of self. For example, elephants, I believe they recognize themselves, like if they look themselves in the mirror, they can say, well, this is me. So then, for example, the dogs, like if they look into the mirror, they just start to bark.
Right, yes.
Why are we more special than others? And if God created us as his own image, who created the other creatures in the world and in the universe? So yeah. why do we have this appearance, no? And
okay. Yeah.
Probably. But if so, and if God is God, why do God need us to have a purpose? What is this purpose for?
Yes.
If he can't do anything there, you know?
Yes.
So, yeah.
Okay, wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
thank you for the questions.
You want to start with the animals one, because that's come up here as well.
Yes.
Essentially, sense of self. Yes.
Right.
Reasoning powers.
Yes.
How are we kind of saying human beings are distinct from other animals?
Yeah.
If you want to chuck in Homo sapiens and Neanderthals as well, Homo erectus, that's another question.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah. This is a great question. And I think what we clearly do see is that animals are capable of extraordinary things, and they probably have, you know, when you watch things like Blue Planet and Green Planet, you see that they've got kind of sonars, things, and ability to sort of sense their environment in ways that kind of go way beyond what we are able to do. In general, when we, I think you've picked out some really helpful exceptions to the rule, but in general, there are levels of consciousness in the animal kingdom, clearly, and we see that even in our household canines, that they have an emotional life, they're happy to see us when we get home, and they're scared when there's thunder and lightning. But in general, that awareness is an external awareness of their environment, so they're responsive to environmental stimuli and cues and all of that sort of thing. In general, it doesn't seem to be that there is that reflexive self-awareness. Now, you mentioned the case of elephants. I hadn't come across that particular one. How you get an elephant in front of a mirror is like highly kind of commendable. Whoever ran that study, some poor PhD student trying to get the data from that one. But anyway, but you're right, if you do that with a dog, they think it's another animal because they don't, and that's an indicator from behavioral science that most animals don't have reflexive self-awareness to the extent that human beings do. Now, you might see instances of it in elephants and dolphins, but the general impression here is that there is a difference between humans and creatures. Why that is the case? That's a great question. I guess I don't know, actually, the answer to that. I mean, God kind of is a God that likes to create in diverse ways, and maybe he thought that maybe, you know, how sometimes when you kind of have less of one thing, you have more of another. Maybe, you know, and we know that animals probably can connect with each other in ways that humans don't. Who knows? But what it certainly doesn't, so the biblical narrative is that we believe that God made all of the creatures, sea, land. Of course, the process is involved. Christians talk about that till the cows come home. And humans are a high point in this creative process, but that doesn't give us license to kind of exploit and do what we like with the natural world. In fact, when it says that they will rule over the fish of the sea, the birds in the air, and so on, that means have responsibility for. And the image of God has connotations of you're going to be accountable to someone. So in the ancient world, the kings would set up an image of themselves in the countries that they were ruling over as a reminder to the citizens that they were accountable to the king. And in a similar way, the image of God in us ought to be a reminder that we will be accountable to the creator of this world for how we treat it and how we care for it, which is why there is a very, very strong biblical precedent for caring for the environment, for being at the forefront of climate change kind of measures and policy making, and all of that is very, very important, that we are because our position in the hierarchy brings with it a responsibility. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I've only answered a few of your questions, but maybe, yeah. Thank you.
Who else would like to ask a question? One of the back.
Yeah, thank you for the question. There's a lot in there that we could say. And I think that, You know, and that is certainly a view that is out there, that sort of moral values are something that has kind of evolved over time and have been sort of honed through evolutionary processes, and you know, what is good for sort of survival is the good and the right, and so on. And that isn't necessarily, it's actually not incompatible with Christian thought on this. What is inherent in that thinking is that it is sort of a progression towards a standard that actually exists. That there is a sense of kind of goodness that exists, that this whole process has been working towards. And I suppose my question would be, what is that standard, and where does that come from? And in what kind of universe does that sit most comfortably? Does it sit most comfortably in a universe without a morality kind of built into it at the beginning? Does it sit in a universe where right and wrong are kind of incidental things that arise from natural processes? Or does it sit most comfortably in a universe where there is a God that exists, that has always existed, that set that universe in motion? And by the way, partly in response to this other question, not out of necessity, that God didn't need to, but out of choice, an act of love, which is an expression of the morality that was in the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, right from the beginning. So that I'm not completely answering your question, but more sort of raising another question to say, in which kind of universe does the notion of right and wrong, good and evil, sit most comfortably? And I would argue that while there are very interesting arguments from the secular field about how you can make sense of morality, there's also a very persuasive case that if God exists, that this is entirely at home and exactly what we would expect. Thank you for the question.
I'm not the only one here. Most of us are thinking, how on earth are you building this reservoir of knowledge from brain imaging to human biology to philosophy to morality? It's incredible. One more question before, and then I've got one final question here. Oh, God, we've got one.
These are really very big questions, and they go to the core of our humanity and the reality of living in the world that we live in, where there are all kinds of injustices and forms of suffering. I guess in terms of the first part of your question, when someone is kind of sitting under a weight of I am worthless and nobody seems to care or be doing anything about it, that is something that deeply grieves God's heart. And there are many, many verses in the Bible about how God hates injustice and cares about justice, and which is why that actually when we see something like that, it's quite hard to talk in the abstract. I will do my best, but I know that there are very real situations that sit behind these questions as well. But another thing that it means to be made in the image of God is to fight on behalf of others, to see them freed from oppression and abuse and all kinds of suffering. And that is why many people do that, those that believe in God, those that don't. Whatever you believe, it's still an outworking of the image of God, that there is a need to see justice done on behalf of others. In terms of the value of our lives, I think that you actually highlight an important need for palliative care in a world that kind of says, look, we should just campaign and lobby to just end it and whatever, or just have people languishing in care homes. I think this is one of the biggest challenges that we're facing in the UK. How do we care for an aging population? I think we need good palliative care. I know that's probably not the precise situation that you have in mind, but that actually we need to be ready and willing to sit with people. It costs us, doesn't it? But actually, if that person has inherent value, even if their memory is gone, their speech is gone, everything is gone, we sit with them to the end. And that's really hard and really challenging. And it's been very challenging during a pandemic. And we've been denied and robbed of that opportunity by this pandemic. In terms of beyond death, I mean, these are very, very difficult questions. We're told that God has set eternity in our hearts. We're told that actually we are able to know God even through kind of nature and see kind of signposts to him in all kinds of ways during our lifetime. And that the way to eternal life is through a relationship with Jesus Christ, which is why I am here tonight, which is why events like this are being hosted by Salt Live and other churches across the country and beyond, because it really matters what you believe. God offers eternal life. He has set eternity in every human heart. And no one goes unnoticed by him. We also enter the realm of deep mystery. I think that people, even when their speech is gone and they can't kind of communicate in ways that we do normally, they can still connect with God in their final days and hours as well. And so I want to leave some mystery in this question as well, but come back to a God who loves and who has paid the highest possible price so that we can know him and know him forever.
Well, you actually answered the last question I had in mind. Okay. So, I think it would be wonderful to give Sharon another round of applause. So thank you.